The first public item of public hearing is Senate Bill 293. Mr. O'Leary, if you could give us a rundown.
Chair Barker, thank you, members of the committee. Senate Bill 293 comes to us from the Criminal Justice Commission, and this is a measure that would actually repeal a statute. It would repeal the statute that currently requires local public safety coordinating councils, or LPSCs, to submit an annual report to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, a biennial support to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission regarding the details of each county's early disposition programs. In testimony on the Senate side and in my conversations with Craig Prims, the director of the Criminal Justice Commission, I learned that the LPSCs of each county, while they are currently required to submit these reports every biennium, only two counties currently do. And of the information that those counties provide to the criminal justice system, according to the criminal justice system, it is non-useful to them. So this is something that would essentially repeal this requirement that's not really doing anybody any good, according to the sponsors.
Okay. Question? Discussion?
Could you share with me which counties were involved in that for the lip syncs that were...
My recollection was Multnomah County and Lane County.
Lane, really?
But I'd want to double check with Mr. Prince to make sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Move to a work session.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate Bill 293 be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Take the roll, please. Any discussion? Take the roll, please.
Representative
McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Olson. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 547. Representative Krasinski, Senator. Stuck in time there.
Oh, that's quite all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 547 is coming to you at the request of the Eugene Police Commission. I sit in Eugene as one of the commissioners. We have a situation, and I'll just give you just a little framework as to why this bill is coming forward, where we were concerned as to misidentification of Eugene police officers with both security officers as well as security personnel that served for the University of Oregon. What is in the process now, in fact, they just actually passed it this week, is a change in the city ordinances that will restrict private security agencies from having uniforms that are very similar in style, color, etc., to the Eugene police. We are not able to actually deal with the issue that's at hand as it pertains to the University of Oregon, since it is a governmental entity. But we're hoping that we can get some resolution there. But in doing the discussion regarding that situation, I've brought to the attention of the commission as to what the criminal impersonation of a peace officer is limited to. And current law is only a badge and the ID card. As you can imagine, and there's been cases here in the state, but probably some that have been more noted within the media as to what's happening out of state, where you have individuals that are actually dressing in uniforms that look very similar to law enforcement, and actually gives the impression to the citizen who is confronted by these individuals that they are in fact dealing with law enforcement personnel when they're not. And because of that, I brought forward the bill that's before you now to basically clarify and actually expand that individuals that are dressing in uniform type of apparel with the intent to obtain a benefit or to injure or defraud another person by use of that uniform would in fact be liable as a criminal impersonation of an officer. I think it's a wonderful expansion and needed expansion because as much as we have citizens that are relying on law enforcement, the last thing I want them to have is the impression that they are obligated to do something or could actually cause them to be put at personal risk by someone that is not a sworn police officer within this state by the appearance that they have when they're in these uniforms. That's why the bill's before you, and I hope that that gives you some understanding as to why I believe Senate Bill 547 should in fact be passed to the full committee and hopefully from there to the House floor.
And thank you, Senator. And I noticed you, that it's been amended to add with the intent to obtain benefits, so they really put another piece in there, so if somebody just is, I mean, they have to be doing something trying to defraud.
That's right. I mean,
intentionally.
You know, for us who, you know, follow music and stuff, you know, there's a group called the Police. And if someone is wearing a jersey or a T-shirt that says police on it, that in itself is not going to put them under the arrest. It's when they actually have something that says, like, law enforcement, or it could be police, and they're walking up to someone and demanding some type of action, or they're representing themselves to be something that they're not, then they would be liable under the statute.
The city of Portland, just kind of along the lines of Eugene, they have a city ordinance that says you can't have a deceptively similar uniform, and we, in fact, the people like escorted funerals, you couldn't tell them from real police until that, you know, we kind of pushed that subject and made them change so that people would understand they weren't, I mean, they were what they were. They were motorcycle escorts for funerals, but not police.
And Chair Barker, I mean, the thing that came to our attention that, again, this bill does not address, but to show how scary it can be, as you have just laid it to, in Eugene at the University of Oregon, they rolled out on a burglary at one of the dorms, and it was at night. And they basically thought, one officer thought they had a perimeter set because he looked across and saw what he thought was another officer, and that the person that they were suspecting as to being involved in this was walking toward them, and so they basically were trying to contact them through the radio, and the person was just standing there, and they were very concerned for that person's safety, and they were about ready to take, let's say, evasive actions that could have been deadly. And they realized, unfortunately, that this person was not on their radio waves because it wasn't one of theirs. And they've actually had other situations where the university security have actually rolled out off campus to like a bar fight, and then the public sees maybe six or eight people in uniform standing around, and they're wondering why there has so much force there. And then when and you look at them, they're all in LAPD blue is the uniform that EPD uses, and that's pretty much what the university has adopted. Now, that's something that, again, this bill will not address, but it really raised our concern when we start looking at this and knowing that there are a lot of use of security guards and agencies, and we just don't want to give out the false or misimpression.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Chair. Senator Przanski, so how would this impact on personnel like you were describing, the university police force or private security guards whose uniforms may be confusingly similar? Obviously, they don't have the intent to defraud somebody, but you know, I mean, it does seem like there's a problem in having uniformed folk around who look like they're law enforcement people and aren't really, and I would say this bill probably doesn't quite get there, and I'm not sure what it would take to get there.
Yeah, and I don't. We have to look at those agencies, Chair Barker and Representative McPherson. You have to look at the context of what we can and can't do. We can't really put in place something that's going to impact another governmental unit. And we're not really concerned with that as it pertains. I mean, I'm not concerned with that when it comes to sworn police officers, because we know every officer in this state have gone through similar or the same training, and they have the skills that we think are appropriate for those individuals when they are dealing with the public. When you're dealing with university or private security, they're not sworn police officers. But what we've recognized through our review and some research that's been done, we're not going to be able to pass something that's going to, let's say, prohibit the university system their private security. But what we are going to be able to do is that we're going to be able to make certain that the individuals that may be working for a security outfit, that they are not wearing uniforms that label themselves as police. sheriffs, law enforcement, because they're not. And that's when you look at the definition down at the very end about the law enforcement uniform, and it says bearing the words of, as I've mentioned, those or any other type of words that are similar, that would be the prohibition if, in fact, they are trying to utilize that uniform dress to get a benefit, injure, or defraud another person.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. It does occur to me that probably some security guard personnel, I mean, they wear uniforms that look pretty official, and it's... and I suppose that maybe part of the design of those uniforms may be to try to project greater authority than they in fact have.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does occur to me that this bill, which I think is a good bill, because people don't just look at the badge, they look at the uniform. That's what guides the reaction of the general public to be in assuming a certain level of authority among the people they're encountering. And I suspect that security guard personnel to some extent are trading on that impression that they have greater official authority than they in fact have. And so I suppose that this could be a pushback at private security individuals who put on a uniform and act as though they're police authorized.
Well, I guess I'm not sure if I would use the term pushback, but it clearly wants to distinguish a person that they do not use terms, words that are actually giving the misimpression that they're someone that they're not, and they're using that for those purposes. And clearly, that's exactly, you're right, Representative McPherson. When we discussed the issue with the public safety office for the University of Oregon, which again is private, they're not sworn officers, mm-hmm. they said that they wanted to look very similar as they could to EPD, because they think they got better compliance when they look just like a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the scary part, because that gives off a false impression, and people are, you don't have the same requirements dealing with a private individual as you do with someone that is a peace officer. And they do, as two of the members of this committee know from their life experience and their professions, previous professions, that they have certain rights that we as individuals do not. And what we don't want to do is allow for someone that doesn't have those rights to give that impression and actually get, again, a benefit or injure or defraud somebody based on that representation.
Mm-hmm.
And it just really undermines our whole public safety system. Mm-hmm. When we have that happen. And it's fortunate, I will say, we've heard some cases of up in the greater Portland area where the uniform has in fact been used, and this will in fact hopefully address those type of issues. And it's not per se security individuals that I'm more concerned with. It's really the individual who, as some people would call, the wannabes, or the people that are actually wanting to deceive for whatever that personal gain. And it could be actually a threatening injury to an individual, in sexual context as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And also, just I noted here that you have the false law enforcement identification. So if somebody has the badge case with the phony ID, and there was turned out to be a false allegation. A woman claimed she was taken off the MAX train by somebody claiming to be an inhalator. She recanted that. But those are the kind of things that would be covered by this as well, if that had indeed happened. If somebody said, "I'm the police," fair inspector kind of police thing.
Yeah, Chair Barker, that actually is what the current criminal impersonation of a peace officer is. When you look on lines 10 through basically 15. That's what we currently have on the books.
Great.
And so what we'll be doing with this bill is just expanding it to the uniforms.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions, discussion? Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Move to a work session. Somebody?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 547A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? I'm going to call a roll, please.
Mm-hmm. Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. I hope McPherson will carry that. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 370.
You could do a great job.
Ingrid Swenson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ingrid Swenson. I'm with the Office of Public Defense Services. Senate Bill 370 would basically prevent the attorney-client privilege from being lost when a protected communication is made to my office for the purpose of providing information or making a complaint about a public defense provider. Last session, the legislature passed a measure requiring the Public Defense Services Commission to adopt a formal complaint policy. We did that, and the policy permits members of the public, the courts, the district attorneys, and others, including clients, to make complaints about public defense providers, either the fees for their services or the quality of the services that they provide. After we adopted the policy in October of 2004, and a copy of that is attached to my testimony, we did indeed begin receiving additional complaints. We'd always received them and handled them pursuant to an informal policy, but we began to receive additional complaints, some about costs, but mostly about quality of representation. And in trying to investigate those complaints, we found that it is frequently necessary to get some pretty detailed information from clients or from public defense providers about the relationship between the attorney and the client and the information which the attorney has received from the client. For example, I set out a couple of examples in my testimony, but sometimes clients will call or write us and indicate that they are not able to work successfully with their attorney because of something that the attorney is either doing or not doing. We try to repair those relationships when we can so that it isn't necessary for this client to ask the court to appoint some other lawyer. And in attempting to do that, we ordinarily would contact the attorney and discuss the client's concern directly with the attorney. And it can be anything from my lawyer isn't contacting me, isn't calling me, isn't keeping me informed, to my lawyer refuses to call this eyewitness whom I've identified as somebody who can exonerate me. So in that sort of situation, it wouldn't be unusual to talk to the attorney and say, what is it you're going to be doing in this case, and is it appropriate to call this witness? And the lawyer may say, no, you know, I've talked to this witness, frankly, and this person wouldn't be supportive of that defense. Or my client has given me certain information, which would be privileged information, that shouldn't be disclosed if the privilege is to be protected. We also get complaints from judges and others about lawyers spending too much time on cases or spending funds unwisely. And in those cases as well, we often have to inquire into the details of the representation, why the lawyers are doing what they're doing. And when that causes them to need to disclose to us privileged information, our concern is that that privilege may be lost, and we don't think it should be. Neither the client nor the lawyer should be put in the position of having to give up the privilege in order to provide us with the information we need to process a complaint. So this bill is narrowly drafted. It creates a very narrow provision that basically says the privilege will not be lost in these circumstances when the lawyer or the client reveals privileged information just for the purpose of assisting in resolution of a complaint.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ms. Swenson, you'll need to refresh me a little bit on the attorney-client privilege. It's a privilege that belongs to the client and is waivable by the client. So in a case where the client was making a complaint about the conduct of the attorney, it would seem that that would be something wouldn't require this change. Am I misunderstanding that?
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, the client would, I believe, be found to have waived a privilege if the client complained about an attorney and provided information to us that was part of a privileged communication. Waiver would occur. The case law on waiver by disclosure on the attorney's part is a little less clear, I think, because clients are deemed to have given their attorneys permission to make disclosures under certain circumstances. And there's even case law in which indicates that most lawyers have the authority from their clients to waive it in particular circumstances. Now, with respect to complaints, there is a provision in the privilege which basically says that the privilege does not apply if the attorney makes the disclosure in response to a complaint. And that's the provision which is troubling to us, because understandably, if a client sues an attorney, then the attorney should be free to disclose privileged information in order to defend against the claim. But we don't want our complaint process to automatically trigger that waiver. It shouldn't, because we're trying to repair the relationship. It's not like a lawsuit where the lawyer needs to defend himself or herself. We'd like the privilege to survive, and there's no policy reason that I can think of that would support waiver under those circumstances.
Okay. The follow-up, if I could.
Yeah.
I'm savoring the words here a little bit just to make sure I track how this is structured. So it looks like the focus of it, the language, is that the communication which is allowed despite the privilege doesn't then cause the privilege to disappear or to be impaired. That is, that, and I know that this is an issue in attorney-client privileges, is that sort of limited waiver or disclosure can then trigger a broader impairment or disappearance of the privilege, and that's really what the focus of the bill is on, is that to make sure that if one's operating within this narrowly prescribed zone, that you don't then inadvertently or as a result of that cause a broader waiver or destruction of the privilege.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that's correct. In addition, I think there are occasions when we get into pretty detailed discussion about what has been said between attorney and client, so it may be a considerable part of the privileged information. But yes, we would be concerned about waiving the privilege generally because of a limited disclosure as well.
Okay.
Can I ask an example? You gave the client says, I gave them the name of a witness, and so then you ask him, why didn't you proceed? He said, I talked to the witness, the guy's a liar, he's a complete flake. And so if that isn't protected, then would somebody be able to get that in discovery? Would the district attorney be able to get that information in discovery if it wasn't protected here?
And, Mr. Chair, my example may not have been the best, because that wouldn't be a privileged communication. That would be a confidence that the lawyer would keep on behalf of his
right.
client, and we do have a confidentiality
okay.
Provision which would protect that. But I use that example to say that then we would need to inquire further about details of the representation which might include privileged discussions with the client. So I apologize. I think
okay.
it wasn't the best example.
Okay. But if somehow that you're not protected now, who could somebody subpoena that? Or, I mean, what is that the danger?
Mr. Chair, my concern is not so much that it could be subpoenaed, although I suppose it could. Our confidentiality policy would probably prevent disclosure in response to a subpoena. But I would think that, for example, if a district attorney made a complaint in a case, let's say that he complained that lawyer X was spending too much money on this case and hiring all kinds of experts, and I investigated that complaint and received confidential information from the attorney, that district attorney could then say, I'm going to inquire of this client, if he testifies in the trial, about what he and his lawyer discussed about these issues, because I know that, you know, during the course of the investigation of my complaint, that these issues might have come up. I mean, it's fairly an unusual circumstance to think that the prosecutor would know directly about it. And yet, it just was our belief that if the privilege is not there, that the client is vulnerable to that kind of disclosure at some point.
And I may be getting ahead to the next bill, I'm not sure here, but there was a case a few years ago, which you're probably aware of, up in Bend, where there was a murder trial, and the public defender brought turned out to be a pen pal of the guy's from England. I don't know if you're familiar with that. He brought it on a taxpayer's dime, and it was a woman. Just to, you know, sit and hold a guy's hand in trial. And when the Bend paper exposed that, then the lawyer paid that out of his own pocket. But so this wouldn't prevent that kind of investigation from showing something like that. If that's, I mean, I wouldn't want people to be able to do those kind of things, inappropriate expenditures of the defense. So this would not, I don't think this, what you're doing, would interfere with the investigation. It would uncover something like that.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. I think it's the idea is to facilitate our investigation so that we have complete and thorough information, that is with respect to the next bill, about those kinds of expenses.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Olson.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. Ingrid, I'm telling you, I'm struggling with this bill, and I don't even see, of course, I realize that this is fairly technical. Could you maybe give me a real-life case scenario of the impact that this, where you're wanting to go with this measure, that could help me get a little bit better view of this?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson. So we receive complaints. Supposing we receive a complaint from a judge, and the judge says, lawyer X is fairly routinely charging a lot of attorney's fees. The judge knows that at the end of the case because they impose attorney's fees as part of sentences, so they know the amount, and they might say, you know, this particular lawyer is charging too much money. And would you please investigate whether that is the case? In order to do that, and we would make some preliminary inquiries and say, well, really, his fees are normal for this kind of case, and we might not go a lot further if that were the issue. But if, in fact, we looked at his fees in a number of cases and said, well, that is unusual, it seems to be high, we would want to talk to that attorney and explore exactly what the attorney is doing in those cases and why. So we're getting into the intimate details of his representation. Now, he can say, I don't want to talk to you, and we'd say, fine, well, we probably won't be permitting you to do this work any longer if you can't cooperate with us and provide this kind of information. But it is necessary to get into the intimate details of the case. And I'm thinking of more than one investigation where after reviewing the complaint, talking initially with the lawyer, and then reviewing the district attorney's entire file in the case, that it was necessary for us to then request the attorney's permission to get even more information from the file. statements of the client can be extremely relevant to the complexity of the case, to the decisions the attorney makes about which avenues of defense to pursue and which not to, determinations about credibility of the witnesses, including the defendant, if the defendant's going to testify. So sometimes these cases are open cases. Others are closed, although basically a case isn't closed until the time for appeal has either passed or an appeal has been filed and issued. So during that period of time, we're asking the lawyer to sacrifice his client's privilege in order to respond to our request for information. It just doesn't seem appropriate to do that. That client, who may be, you know, not implicated in any issue at all, not have his privilege intact after our investigation is complete. Because we're doing it for the purpose of either assuring quality of services that our providers give, or exploring waste of public funds. So we're doing it for public purposes. It's not for the benefit of that particular client for the most part. And so it seems inappropriate to have the privilege waived. And we would have some concern that lawyers who were sensitive to those issues would say, I cannot give you that information. And they probably should be saying that. But they trust us not to be seeking information which they shouldn't be providing. And we may be in a position of having to say, no, I need this information, but maybe you better not give it to me, because if you do, you know, your client may lose this privilege. It's a major concern for us when we deal with this information. And we do like to feel comfortable that we can ask for any information at all without damaging the client.
Okay.
Let me follow up on that, just to, I mean, maybe beating this into the ground, but I think what happens then is that the privilege is still intact, but that the commission is within the circle of the privilege, so that, for example, if there were information that was being revealed that was contrary to the interests of the patient or the client, say it was an issue about mental state and whether they had the proper mental state or whether they were not guilty by reason of insanity, and there were issues about exploration of that line of defense, that the commission accessing that information would mean that it was still privileged information as to anybody else. Isn't that really the key of this? Is that the commission can get information without damaging the integrity of the privilege as to any other place it might be disclosed to? And what I think, at least by implication, would then happen is that the commission would be obligated to not disclose to anyone else.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that is correct. That's okay. My understanding okay. of how it would work.
Thank you.
Okay. Move to a work session.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 370A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Okay, and Representative McPherson. And we'll move on to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 371.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Ingrid Swenson, Office of Public Defense Services. This bill is obviously very similar to Senate Bill 370, and it just addresses a different situation. This would prevent the privilege from being lost when the communication is disclosed to my office for the purpose of seeking non-routine expenses. So this is the kind of situation you were thinking about in the Bend area, Mr. Chair. Attorneys court-appointed counsel are eligible to obtain for their clients additional services beyond legal representation. Obviously, they may need the advice of experts. They may need to do some investigation in a case. And for that purpose, they are required to seek pre-authorization of those expenditures from my office. They submit a written document which includes information about the case and why the particular goods or services are needed in the defense of the case. In order to approve those authorizations, we are required to find that they are, quote, necessary and reasonable for the defense of the case. And, of course, this applies not just in criminal cases, but in juvenile cases, civil commitment cases, and all the other cases in which people are entitled to court-appointed counsel. It is not unusual in these cases for us to, again, ask very intimate information about the case and where the case is going and what the purpose of the evidence is. And here again, our concern is that when we request that information and obtain it, that the client may lose the privilege against disclosure of privileged communications. I suppose, well, there are many, many examples of the kinds of information that need to be obtained. Let's talk about an aid and assist in a situation where it seems to the attorney that the client is not able to communicate effectively with the attorney, so that the attorney isn't certain about how to proceed in the case. It may appear to the lawyer that the client has a significant mental illness, and perhaps the jail will report that this person is acting bizarrely, something to that effect. Then the attorney would apply to us and say, I need the assistance of a psychologist to examine this client to determine whether he is currently able to aid and assist in his representation in this case. In order for us to determine whether that's appropriate in this case, we often talk to the lawyer about, well, you know, have you made an effort to discuss the facts of the case with the client? Yeah. And the lawyer will respond and will say, yeah, and he says, you know, and he'll tell me exactly what his client said about the facts of the case. Now, that may be just to illustrate the sort of bizarre reasoning that the client is using, but it is disclosing confidential information that the client has provided to the lawyer and that would be privileged and is privileged. But we do need to ask for those kinds of things. For example, sometimes a defense attorney will request the services of an expert on DNA analysis, and we will examine the request. And in those cases, since they're wanting to sort of second-guess the state laboratory folks on DNA analysis, we need to know what role the DNA analysis will play in that case. I mean, is there a confession? Is there, are there fingerprints? Are there eyewitnesses to the offense? And if so, how does all that weigh into a decision of whether we really ought to be looking at the DNA evidence? And the statements of the client, all that kind of information has to be balanced in order for us to sort of make a reasonable, rational decision about whether this is actually necessary in this case. So once again, it's a concern that we be able to receive all the information we need in order to make good decisions without jeopardizing the client's rights.
I was just trying to think, and I'll preface this by saying that we had complaints last year that there's an over expenditure of that kind of money for the public defender, and there was precious few cases brought to show anything like that. But so this was the other case I was thinking of. There was a case in Astoria where the defense wanted to model. There was a murder case. They wanted a model of the interior of a tugboat, and so they had to hire a craftsman essentially to rebuild the inside of the boat. And then the defense decided he wasn't going to use it, so he destroyed it, and the prosecutor was upset because he would like to have used it since the taxpayers had just bought that. But so these kind of things all that would still be disclosable. It just wouldn't be what the lawyer said, my client said, and so on.
Mr. Chair, with respect to complaints about those kinds of expenditures, yeah, this bill, the idea is to protect the privilege, but and ORS 135055 basically says that we cannot disclose to the district attorney any information about non-routine expenses until the case is concluded. But at that point, yes, we certainly can, and we, in the meantime, can explore misuse of funds or the effort to obtain funds that are not clearly justified.
Okay. I mean, it appears to me that this would facilitate you doing that.
Mr. Chair, that's the intention.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 371. Representative McPherson, do you want to do that?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 371 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative McPherson will carry that to the committee. Is there any? Thank you very much, Ms. Fox. Is there any other business?
This is a
beautiful one.
You didn't make me work too hard.
You didn't even have to do the last one.
I don't think I did anything.